This is RN and you're with The Country Breakfast. Let's get some dirt under the fingernails and join our rural reporters. Oh, I hope you're not feeling too squeamish today, as our first story involves rotting meat and maggots. But it's a worthwhile process, as the resulting flies are used to pollinate a vegetable crop. On a somewhat sweeter note, the Moffat family celebrates a century of pineapple growing on Queensland's Sunshine Coast, and you get to meet Joyce Wilkie and her heritage-listed Berkshire pigs.
What we loved about the Berkshires were that they were energetic pigs. That's good for us in the garden. I love the prick ears. I'm not so keen on floppy ears, that's just a whimsy. The real deciding factor was what it looks like on the plate.
Oh, who could resist having stories about both ham and pineapples on the same program? Those stories coming up, plus a visit to a hairdresser who set up her salon at the Warrnambool Sale Yards. But first, get your fly swat ready. We're off to Tasmania to visit a farm that breeds flies.
Yeah, well, you've come on a lovely day, and these are tunnels with shade cloth walls and plastic roof, so that the brassica crop inside is protected from outside insects so it doesn't get cross-pollinated. The cauliflower plants are actually in full flower, and we've got bees in the house, and I also breed flies to help with the pollination.
When confronted by a swarm of flies, most people reach for the fly spray. But not Alan Wilson. This vegetable grower from Northdown in northern Tasmania doesn't want to kill them. He wants to breed them to help pollinate his cauliflower crop. Hello, I'm Hilary Burden. Alan doesn't grow the cauliflowers for the fresh vegetable market. They're harvested for their seed, which he sells to a company in nearby Devonport. Flies apparently rival bees when it comes to pollination, so Alan thought it was worth trying this two-pronged approach. He just had to figure out a way to successfully breed the flies for use on his crops. And a word of warning before we go any further, this story does involve some pretty graphic content. You breed flies?
I breed flies, which has been an interesting thing to learn about the last few years, yes. Well, it starts off in a little bush hut further away because it's a bit smelly. And I use any meat material I can lay my hands on, and the flies blow that naturally just from the environment. So then I have a nice amount of maggots, which when they pupae into their little cocoons, I then bring them up and put them in the house to hatch out within the house. But that's been an interesting journey, in that I started off in just with some dog meat scraps or such in a 20-litre bucket, and to my surprise I found that maggots can climb out of a 20-litre bucket. So then I thought, I'll just put them in a plastic shopping bag and I won't have anything to wash, and it'll be easy just to toss it away and dispose of it. To my surprise again, I quickly learnt that that was no barrier. They just ate their way clean out of that, and I had crawlies fairly deep on the floor in the little shed where that was happening. And so then the brain started to work, and I thought, well, what happens naturally outside? Ah, yes, they've got a carcass with a hide over it, because they want to get in under something or into the ground to pupate. So then I used some coir, ground-up coir, in the containers to mimic soil. And if they can get under something or burrow down into something like that, there they stay, and they're very happy.
Right, okay. Well, you've brought me to the tunnel. Let's go in and have a look.
Okay. Yep, that door needs to
close
before this one's open.
Okay, we're inside. Oh, bees?
Bees and flies.
And flies together.
Flies are being a bit uncooperative. They're up there trying to get out instead of down on the flowers, but there's a lot working the flowers as well.
They're beautiful, like cauliflower flowers, aren't they? Very pale yellow. And yeah. It's how big is this tunnel?
It's about 60 by 8, I think, metres. And I've got six of those. And we have three rows of so-called male plants and the rest are female plants. So we're crossing two varieties to get the line of seed that the seed company requires.
And there is a smell in here. What am I actually smelling?
Well, once I bring the containers up from my little bush hut, I then procure some ox livers and they're in aluminium trays and with coir underneath them in the hope that the first crop of flies will blow that and create a second generation within the house.
They don't seem to be bothering us, these flies. They're quite happy to be elsewhere.
Yeah, today, when it's nice and warm, I think sometimes they tend to get on you and crawl about, but...
Ox livers. They're big.
They are, yes. But it's a cheap source of protein, because I basically get three varieties of flies. I get the brown bush fly and the blue one, and then the green one that's involved in the fly strike on sheep.
And so from here, what's the process?
Once the female rows have set pods, the male plants are removed, and then the female ones are left to hopefully develop plenty of seed within the pods and allowed to dry off and ripen, and then they're racked and thrashed. Servag then do a cleaning process on them to remove any pods or straw material, foreign matter, and then packed by Servag and exported to France.
And the idea of keeping them under tunnel is that there's nothing else that can influence or cross-pollinate with the cauliflower seed.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, they're tested for purity. That's one of the requirements.
It's interesting, the combination of flies and bees. Is that an unusual thing to see in terms of pollination, cross-pollinating? Normally you hear about bees, but I'm not sure many people might be aware of flies having a pollinating role as well.
No, well, I wasn't aware of flies, and we initially just used bees and probably didn't achieve very outstanding seed set. So Servag were aware that they used flies in Europe, so that was the suggestion was made. But when you think about it, I mean, that happens outside, doesn't it? I mean, you don't necessarily see it, and an orchardist or whoever may not breed flies, but they're there. And they do, standing here watching them, they crawl around over the flowers, obviously chasing the nectar, I guess, and in the process, they're transferring pollen.
Good. Well, I guess you're going to take me to where this all starts. You were talking about the maggots. I'm brave.
Okay. No, we can have a look at that.
Ooh, flies at the door. Do you have to do a fly count, or it is what it is?
No, it is what it is. Just on the left.
Oh, here we go. This is your hut. Okay, I'll just park by those pipes. We're joined on our trip down to the bush hut by Alan's wife, Judith, who it appears is a bit jealous of her husband's fly breeding business.
I have been asking for a little gazebo, barbecue hut, a little something in the garden for about 42 years. And what happens? There's one built here for the fly.
Yeah, I've just built a sturdy frame out of second-hand timber. I've got some tea tree poles across the top, spaced apart, so I can hang the material that I'm using for the flies to blow. The maggots fall out when they're ready into a container underneath that I'll have some coir in. At that stage, they can be taken up to the cauliflower tunnels and put in there so the odour's not about where other people are working. And yeah, my little bush hut, as I call it, it's got hessian walls and a plastic roof. And as you can see, the flies are very much at home in here. They like being in the warm, sheltered spot, I guess. Yeah.
We've got... I'm here with Jacob, who is Alan Wilson's grandson. Hello, Jacob.
Look, Jacob.
Hi.
What's your granddad showing you?
What are they? Are they maggots? Oh. Hundreds or thousands of them, aren't there?
What do you think of that, Jacob?
They will turn into flies for me, hopefully. Isn't that marvellous?
They're quite gross, aren't they?
They will have hatched out, but...
Tell me, I'm a novice. The flies grow out of the larva laid by maggots, is that right?
No, it's very much like a butterfly life cycle, or a lot of insect life cycles. The maggot is the grub. When he burrows in under something or into this coir, he transforms into his outer skin turns into a little brown black pupae, little cocoon.
Mm-hmm.
Looks quite hard. And then the magic happens inside that over a period of time, depending on the temperature, and out comes a fly. Which way, Hillary, does he come out? forwards or backwards, would you think?
I would guess that he would come out forwards into the world.
That's what I thought too initially, until I observed one emerging, and to my amazement, they came out backwards. And when I thought about it, a fly only has a preposterous, I think the word is, or something like that. He only drinks, he doesn't chew things. But on the end of his two back legs are two very sharp little prongs, which he digs a hole in the end of the cocoon, and out he comes.
I've watched it. I observed it.
Judith, what do you think of Alan's new interest in terms of breeding flies for cauliflower seeds?
It's amazing, and he's become an expert on fly breeding. Look over there,
oh
Hilary.
My God.
Oh, they've escaped. Oh, no. Actually, oh, it's the stuff of bad dreams, isn't it?
Oh, yes, you could say that again. Judith Wilson, wife of fly breeder Alan Wilson, ending that somewhat gruesome story from Hilary Burden in northern Tasmania. Still to come on Rural Reporter, farmers are queuing up for a trim at their local sale yard salon in Warrnambool. A family celebrates a century of pineapple farming in Queensland, and Berkshire pigs prove a tasty choice for two Canberra breeders.
What we loved about the Berkshires were that they were energetic pigs. That's good for us in the garden. I love the prick ears. I'm not so keen on floppy ears, that's just a whimsy. The real deciding factor was what it looks like on the plate. We've got a bit more marbled fat and just the best tasting meat. It is really, really beautiful pork.
Joyce Wilkie and her partner Michael Plain are both relatively new to farming. They've taken up a small farming block just outside of the Australian Capital Territory, where they're concentrating their efforts on breeding and eating Berkshire pigs. Hello, Michael Kavner here. The Berkshires are a heritage breed with a long history. They were mentioned in dispatches by Oliver Cromwell's men. They even had the patronage of Queen Victoria. But the fat and flavour they were famous for then saw them fall from grace in a modern health-conscious world, and the breed was listed as endangered. It's taken true believers like Joyce and Michael to help bring them back into mainstream diets.
Fat seems to be confronting. Our children, for example, are a bit horrified at the quantity of fat that we sometimes eat. But things are changing, and that's happening from the good chefs down. The fact is that people make blanket decisions about fats, but there's good fats and bad fats. And the fat on pigs is, particularly if they've been on pasture, the omega acids, the omega-3s and omega-6s are in balance. It's monounsaturated fat. It's healthy fat. There is a percentage of people in the population that have also discovered that as well as these fats being really good for us, they're also where most of the flavour is. The pork without fat can be quite tasteless and dry, and when it's mainly exposing people to this stuff.
The fat issue, how do you actually then turn around to people and explain to them that you've got a breed that dates back to Oliver Cromwell's time at least, well documented and then went out of favour, and you're telling them to eat a pig that's got more fat?
Bacon. I always introduce them to bacon. Somehow or other, the fat in bacon doesn't seem like fat. And the other thing that's really interesting about fat is if you cook one, which we sometimes do is on a special occasion, is cook one whole, spit roast it, the fat becomes something else. It becomes a jelly. It actually renders on the animal and hot. I've seen people eat this stuff like it was lollies. For some reason, they don't make the mental jump that they're eating fat. They would in the morning because what you get is lard. It's about people realising that our diet has to include fat. And if we're going to include fat, why not include really delicious, healthy, tasty fat grown from animals that have been looked after properly?
What do you think are the best parts of the Berkshire?
One shouldn't disclose the cut one. That is really the choice cut, because the less people that know that the neck is the best piece of a pig, the better, because people just don't know. And that means we can have all the necks. We're suddenly eating a meat that we feel good about. We've brought into our lives good food and also some wonderful, wonderful friends, because our breeding sows, you get to know them. They're like pets. They really are.
At the moment, they're all in their stalls. How much free range do they get?
They're in their stalls when they're farrowing and they've got access out the back. But unmated sows, and particularly the weaners that we're growing on for the table, they work in our vegetable garden and they're out all the time. They've got little movable hutches. They're in an electric fence. They get moved every couple of weeks onto fresh grass. and they're outside, they're free range.
Pigs are very outgoing creatures and they're quite intelligent. When it comes to Berkshires, what do they like to work with?
They're like small children. They're like dogs. You've got to be disciplined. And it's about early training. As well as putting stuff on the plate, the very best of our stuff we want people to come and buy to breed on with, particularly our boars, well, but all of our animals to be tamed. So Mike comes out every morning with bowls of apples, hand feeds them. I'm never scared to go into the run with anybody. But on the other hand, you've seen CJ, our boar. I reckon he'd be close to 400 kilos. You've got to be respectful and mindful that as a fully grown animal, they can be dangerous. And so you don't want to forget what's behind the cute face ever.
Dad used to plough, with a mouldboard plough, behind a couple of horses. He could swear too, if there's any roots left behind. Because we used to get into trouble for leaving. The horses would come to a standstill and he'd just about go over the shafts.
85-year-old Rick Moffat, reminiscing about the early days of pineapple farming on Queensland's Sunshine Coast, when horses, not tractors, pulled the ploughs. Hello, I'm Lara Webster. We might hear a lot about farming families leaving the land, but the Moffats are digging in for the long haul. For more than a century, they've been growing pineapples on their farm, Allendale Pines, in the shadows of the Glasshouse Mountains.
We got bulldozers in to clear the land then, make it a bit easier, and they used to tear them up with their big rippers at the back. Yeah, and then we got tractors to plough. Harvesters, yeah, that's right.
Rick and his wife Margaret have handed over control of the farm to two of their sons, Brian and Steve, and grandson Shane has also returned to continue this rich family tradition. And Margaret, now you've spent just as much time with the pineapples as Rick has. Tell me about some of your time working by Rick's side.
Yeah, well, we got married in 1955, had three children, three sons in 4 years, and then when the youngest one was four, I started to help on the farm. They'd bring in their basket loads of pineapples, drop them on the back of the truck, and us women would top them and put them in the bin.
We're standing out here in the paddock looking out across fields of pineapples. What keeps you in the industry? Brian?
We don't have much else to do, so we've got to stick with it. But yeah, just enjoy what you're doing every day. So, but as far as what the changes in the farm, like better machinery, you know, air-conditioned cabs, that detopping boom that you see there has made a hell of a difference.
I did notice that the motto, the farm motto, is dare to be different. Can I ask where that came from?
Well, don't look at us. That was there.
Talk to Steve.
He's different. Just one of those silly things. You've got a bent sense of humour in some people's opinion, but yeah, we just thought at that stage we were doing a lot of different trials with different things, and then people would come along and say, why would you bother doing that? What's the gain? And we just say, well, we're trying to do something a bit different. Everybody else seems to do the same thing, and then when someone gets onto something, they all want to do the same thing, so we've always tried to stand alone and just do it a little bit different to suit ourselves, and a lot of people probably disagree with what we do, but we're still here.
How do the family dynamics work?
A lot of arguments. Yeah, over the time. But now it's I leave Brian alone, he leaves me alone. I do all the counts, and Brian does all the spraying and then looks after all the, what you say, the program of harvesting fruit.
Rick, Margaret, What makes it work?
I don't
love,
know.
Love. If you love a person enough, you'll...
4X.
Yeah.
4X at the end of the day, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we've got on good together.
Yeah.
Now, Shane, you're Brian's son. We've heard a little bit about the good times and the bad times. You've been off the farm for a little while. What's brought you back?
Brought me back to try and keep the farm going in the future. And for when Pa finishes, I'm here to take over his job, hopefully, if I can keep up to his standard.
How's that going so far?
Yeah, not too bad.
What's the future look like to you?
Not too bad. I think I can keep it going in the near future and keep these blokes going on their feet.
How do you think you can do that?
Just improve as the years go on. The world is changing, I suppose. The farm needs to change in the newer ways.
Exciting times ahead, you reckon?
Yeah, I think so, yeah, hopefully.
Massage chairs, heated footrests, cleansing air mists. These days, a trip to the hairdresser can be pure luxury. A place to tune out, relax. That's why I'm a bit surprised to find one set up here at the Warrnambool Sale Yards in Western Victoria. Hello, I'm Danny Grindley. Hairdresser Brooke Neville has ditched the glamour of a Main Street salon to set up in a mobile site cabin, giving farmers the chance to get to the sale and get a haircut all on the same day. She doesn't even seem to mind the smelly boots.
A gentleman said to me he thought there was a niche in the market for a hairdresser at the sale yards because there were so many blokes out here, and I was cutting men's hair full-time then in a salon and thought I could give it a try.
Can you describe the setup here? How have you put this together?
Basically a little site hut on wheels with a sink and a bench for them to sit on and wait and read the paper or the magazines, and a single chair and mirror.
And do you have to get a special permit or anything
like that? I do, yeah, and liability insurance. And the city council are good to me.
How is it going? How's business?
Yeah, good. I've been coming for 10 years and I'm probably on a quiet day I'll do 10 or 12, and on a busy day I can do up to 20 or 25 haircuts.
Why do you think it works?
Oh, just no frills, no appointments, and I think I chew their ears off as well as give them a haircut.
Well, that would be a part of it because, you know, obviously they wouldn't get into town and they wouldn't see people very often. So
that's right, yeah. Some of them, it's their only trip in for the week, and it's one less job to do in town. I've just bought some acreage myself, so they ask me how that's going, and sometimes I give out Christmas shopping advice. I was very sad when I thought they were going to shut the sale yard, so I was quite excited we got the green light to stay here.
How often would you get your hair cut, sir?
Oh, when it gets long.
Probably every 6 weeks for you.
So we're a regular?
Yeah, he is, yep.
Yeah, very good. You don't have to, well, you don't like, you've got boots on and you walk into the barbers in the street, you can smell the cut boots. And
some of the young girls don't like that, do they?
No.
Well, to me, it seems ingenious. Have you heard of others doing it?
Apparently there's another girl in Ballarat now, and that's about all I know of. Yeah.
You could be starting a trend here. You might have competition.
I know. No, I'll certainly fight for my spot, though, if someone else tries to come out here.
A scented candle in the corner of this small room fails to penetrate the overpowering stench of cow dung and urine. But Brooke's clients make up for their smelly boots by helping out in many small ways, not least of which is reversing the mobile salon into place.
Such a nice bunch out here. Everyone's so friendly. When I was first out there hooking it on, they all come running and help me. Here you go, we'll help you line up. And their wives baked for me at Christmas and brought me in presents when I had the kids. And Chad was born at the end of November, so I had to come back for Christmas because they all needed haircuts. So he was in the capsule in the corner, so they've seen my kids grow up. And the kids are part and parcel sometimes when they come in for a haircut. They have to deal with them.
What are the haircut requests? Anything fancy?
No, I have pretty... mostly short back and sides. A few have it shaved. Yeah, a few just have the clippers all over. And yeah. I've got a few young ones that let me get a bit creative, but, well, I usually just start cutting without asking them now, if it's a regular. And then halfway through, I'm like, oh, same as usual.
And there's no cappuccino or glass of wine, foot rub.
No. I give them rumbles at Christmas.
And that would be worth the trip alone. Hairdresser Brooke Neville certainly knows how to keep her clients happy. Thanks to Danny Grindley for that hair-raising story from the Warrnambool Sale Yards. Great to be with you for A Country Breakfast. I'm Edwina Farley.